Welcome to the Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Alan Cohen about the recent module he wrote on alcohol use disorders. Hello, Alan.
Good evening, Sally.
So, this module was based on a Lancet update on alcohol. What are the big health risks associated with alcohol?
Alcohol contributes to the premature mortality caused by injury, alcoholic liver disease, heart disease and stroke, cancer and gastrointestinal disease. Overall, the total global burden of disease is 4%, which is hard to put into context until you realise it's actually the same contribution as smoking. Interestingly, the contribution of alcohol is greater in developed countries such as the UK and the US, and that episodic drinking, up to the level of intoxication, greatly increases the risk of accidents, injuries and violence and heart disease. So there is an extensive burden of disease related to alcohol and alcohol misuse.
And I was quite surprised when I read the module, because equating it to the harm from smoking, which we all have such an in-depth knowledge and understanding of, really puts that into context, doesn't it? A similar burden of disease.
But for those groups of people who both smoke and use alcohol, that is an extreme burden of disease that is manageable and frequently manageable by supporting changes in behaviour rather than anything more dramatic. And the impact on people's outcomes and length and quality of life is very significant.
Okay, that's very helpful. So which groups, you mentioned different groups, more prevalent in developed worlds and Europe and the US, which groups within that are most at risk?
There's personal and social factors which are associated with things like early initiation and hazardous consumption. So if you start in adolescence drinking heavily, you're more likely to go on into adulthood drinking heavily. Interestingly, parental monitoring and control is associated with heavy drinking. The prevalence of alcohol use disorders in cultures that drink to intoxication. So I was recently working in some of the Central Asian states, some of the stans, where drinking large quantities of vodka is considered normal, and alcohol liver disease is normal. Other personal factors are childhood conduct disorder, and peers who use lots of alcohol are also social factors. There are biological factors, which are quite interesting. The Lancet article talks to the fact that there is a 50 to 70% risk of developing alcohol use is attributable to additive genetic factors. I've read this several times, and I'm not entirely sure I understand what it means. I think what it means is that there are several different genes associated with addictive behaviour, and together they increase the risk of developing alcohol use in some individuals. So a family history of first degree relatives with early onset alcohol use disorder increases the risk of alcohol in the individual patient.
That's very interesting, and I think we all would recognise in patients and their families patterns of behaviour around alcohol and also other substances sometimes where people have been addicted to a variety of things within a family, and it's always hard to unpick the sort of social elements of that from the biological elements, isn't it?
The difficulty, of course, is even if we are able to identify either the personal or social factors or the biological factors, being able to intervene effectively to reduce them is very, very difficult. How does one influence parental monitoring and control if one perceives it to be low? I'm not sure I know that there's an easy answer in a 10-minute consultation for a GP to deal with something like parental monitoring.
No, that's a bigger societal issue rather than necessarily something we can tackle. Yeah.
And I think it's just that we need, it's worthwhile noting it, but understanding that some of the major changes to health outcomes are not always down at the door of the GP to work harder.
No, indeed. So we all know patients who drink too much, but how do we define alcohol use disorders more formally?
It's a difficult area because there are two sets of definitions, and they're not the same. There is the WHO classification of diseases, the ICD-10, that talks about harmful use and dependence. And there is the American term, the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, version 5, which uses different terms. DSM-5 talks about a gradation of severity from mild to moderate severe alcohol use disorder, depending on the number of symptoms present, somewhere between 2 and 11. In contrast, the ICD-10 talks about harmful use, which is alcohol use that is causing actual damage to health, mental or physical, and dependence, a cluster of physiological, behavioural and cognitive phenomena in which the use of alcohol takes on a much higher priority than other behaviours that once had a greater priority. The reason that it's complicating is that different papers that one reads use either DSM-5 or ICD-10 diagnoses. So you can't always compare one paper with another because they are describing different things and using different terms. So the only bit where both DSM-5 and ICD-10 agree is they don't use the word addiction.
Right.
So addiction is not used, but dependence is. Dependence with ICD-10 is a clear-cut single definition. In DSM-5, it's a gradation from white through to black.
Okay. And neither of them are defining on levels of drinking, on units per week?
No, not on the amount of alcohol.
No.
But more about the symptoms that the alcohol causes.
Yeah.
Both of them require a careful history in order to get some idea of what's going on.
Okay. So remind me, what is a unit, at least if we're talking in the UK?
The trouble with a unit is that there is no internationally agreed definition. In the UK, one unit is equivalent to 8 grams of alcohol, whereas in Japan, the term a unit is equivalent to 20 grams of alcohol. So even if we had some international consistency, the individual reporting of the amount of alcohol an individual drinks is very variable. Individuals often underreport the amount of alcohol they consume in the same way most people underreport the number of cigarettes they smoke. Given that people underreport what they drink anyway, if they don't understand what a unit of alcohol is, they're going to misreport it even more. So that trying to assess the level of symptoms based on the quantity of alcohol consumed as reported by the patient is inaccurate.
Okay.
The last bit that is worth remembering is that about half the people with alcohol use disorders will remain undiagnosed if doctors only rely on the clinical acumen. People are very good at misreporting the amount of alcohol that they are drinking. And if we just go on that, we're going to miss half the patients.
So how do we pick up those extra patients?
The advice from the NICE guidelines on identification and management is the use of questionnaires. The ones that were recommended originally by the Directly Enhanced Services was the FAST alcohol screening test, and the Audit C, which is the first three questions of the Audit 10-item questionnaire created by the World Health Organization. These are well validated in primary care, they're designed for primary care, and GPs ought to be familiar with using them.
So what do you say to the people who say, but drinking small amounts is good for your heart, isn't it?
If you're a middle-aged male between 40 and 60, and you drink a really small quantity of alcohol, rather than saying that you do, then there may be a very mild cardiovascular benefit. But the evidence is very equivocal. It certainly doesn't apply to the group who drink most heavily, which is the 18 to 25-year-old group. Certainly there, heavy drinking has no cardiovascular benefit whatsoever.
No. And you mentioned it's only men that there's evidence in. Is there any evidence for women?
Yeah. Sorry, Doc.
Oh, dear. Right. And breast cancer is the other big thing we probably don't think about enough in terms of excess risk with alcohol, isn't it? So keep moving on to investigations. What are the most useful investigations we can do in primary care?
Blood investigations, the three that are most appropriate are the mean corpuscular volume, the MCV, the gamma glutamyl transferase, GGT, which is a sensitive liver enzyme, and then the liver function test overall. None of them are perfect. So they have low sensitivity and specificity. As an example, people who are obese may have an elevated GGT anyway, without any other evidence of alcohol consumption. So the investigations need to be interpreted in the context of the individual patient that's presenting in front of you.
Thinking about where we go, we've identified this person has a likely alcohol misuse disorder. We've checked their bloods mostly for a bit of a baseline in a sense of how their physical health is. What are the psychological treatment options? What can we do?
There are some interventions which are recommended for all people who are drinking hazardously. The characteristic of all of them is that they are relatively short. for psychological interventions, no longer than 30 minutes, but can be as short as 5 minutes. They're usually only 1 to 3 sessions of treatment. Evidence suggests that more frequent brief interventions are more effective than one extended session. And that's quite helpful for general practice. There are 3 particular types of behavioural treatment which have got a good evidence base. The first is formal cognitive behaviour therapy. This works very well, but you do need to be a properly trained cognitive behaviour therapist to deliver it. The second technique is motivational interviewing, which is effective not only for alcohol use disorders, but for numerous other psychological disturbances and long-term conditions. So motivational interviewing is a skill that probably GPs have already got, but maybe have not been on a course to enhance their skill level. It's something that GPs probably ought to consider quite carefully, more training in. It's very effective and a very useful way of helping people to change their behaviour. The third type of behavioural treatment is the 12-step facilitation group therapy, characterised by peer support and a buddy system.
So this is the Alcoholics Anonymous
Alcoholics Anonymous is a bit more than the 12-step facilitation, but certainly that's part of it, yes.
Okay. I've certainly got some patients who've done very, very well with that, and others that had a very negative reaction to it. So it does seem to depend on the patient, doesn't it?
It does. I'm not sure I know what features one could look for in someone's personality to know whether they will do well or poorly with such sorts of group treatment.
Okay, that's helpful.
There is something called FRAMES, which is a brief intervention, and it's got a good evidence base that GPs should be aware of. And FRAMES is an acronym that stands for F for feedback from the clinician on the risk of the person having had alcohol problems. So explaining to the patient that actually alcohol is damaging them, that the responsibility to change is the person, the patient's responsibility, not the doctor, to provide advice when requested, offering a menu for change, offering some empathy, and then something about self-efficacy, which is optimism about that behaviour change works and that the person can undertake it. So that structure is important for the effectiveness of these really short, frequent interventions that can be no more than 5 to 10, 15 minutes.
Okay, so that's a good structure to remember.
And is recommended in the NICE guidelines.
Excellent. We don't often get involved in prescribing medication for alcohol misuse. Mostly, certainly in areas I've worked, that's been something which has largely been advised by specialist services. But it might be helpful for us just to have an overview of what there is. So what drugs do we have for alcohol use disorder?
I agree completely that for the vast majority of GPs, this is something, medication is started by the specialist service, although the GP may follow up the patient. There are 4 drugs: acamprosate, disulfiram and naltrexone are ones which are initiated once the person is abstinent. Nalfamine is licensed for the reduction of alcohol consumption in patients with alcohol dependence who have a high drinking risk level without physical withdrawal symptoms. There are some similarity between the drugs. Certainly there's some similarity between acamprosate and naltrexone. So you need to look at the EKU module for details of those. Disulfiram causes a horrible reaction as alcohol is converted to acetaldehyde and makes the patient flush and feel very unwell. Malformin is a drug that really, for a very small number of individuals, and would only be prescribed by a specialist.
That's helpful. Now to the thorny issue of driving. How do we advise patients about driving if they're misusing alcohol?
In a way, this is actually very straightforward. There is an excellent page on the DVLA website that tells professionals what to do about patients they are concerned about and gives advice to patients about their responsibilities. It's very clear that it is the responsibility of the individual to inform the DVLA if there is a medical reason why they should not be driving. In some cases, the individual cannot or will not tell the DVLA, in which case the GMC provides information as to the GP's responsibility. So far as this EKU is concerned, there are links to those sites if for the GP who feels concerned. If the GP remains concerned about a person driving and finds that the GMC advice is not helpful, they can contact their own medical indemnity provider for information and help.
Yes, and I think in practice, on the few occasions I've been involved in these sorts of situations, if you're thinking of referring to the DVLA without the patient's consent, I would always involve my defence organisation in that process.
I think that the message is, if you are faced with something that you think is ethically difficult, get help from somebody.
Yes.
Be it the GMC, be it your medical indemnity provider, but just make sure that you've asked somebody else, to got their independent view, and you've written down that you've done that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that the clinical record, if you come back to it in 3 months or 6 months or a year, is clear that you were not thinking doing something entirely on your own, but you had taken reasonable advice for the behaviour that you took.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would your take-home message be about alcohol?
Alcohol use disorder is difficult to diagnose, very common, and has as much of an impact on health outcomes as smoking does. So it's something that we should be paying more attention to.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time, Alan, and thank you for listening to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the RCGP.